This is KWAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.
The lower levels of deprivation in the black ghettos of the North. They did very little to improve the economic lot of the masses of Negroes in our country. Not only that, we must come to see that in these movements, we got responses and support because it really didn't cost the nation anything to deal with them. It didn't cost the nation anything to integrate lunch counters. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. And a lot of people really supported us in Alabama and Mississippi and all across the South because they were really against something, not because they were for genuine equality for the black man. They looked at Bull Connor and saw how he was beating us and how brutal he was, and they were really outraged. They looked at Jim Clark and Selma, and they were outraged about it. And so they took a stand for decency. But it was never really a stand for genuine equality for the black man. T.S. Eliot said on one occasion that that is no greater heresy than to do the right thing for the wrong reason. A lot of people were doing the right thing, but they were doing it for the wrong reason. And now when we demand that people do the right thing for the right reason, they begin making excuses and giving all kinds of rationalizations. Now the time has come for genuine equality to come into being for all of God's children. It isn't going to be as easy now to deal with the problem as before because, as I said, it will cost the nation something. It's much easier to integrate lunch counters than it is to eradicate slums. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee an annual minimum income and create jobs. And yet these are the very things that must be done. It's a problem facing all of our urban areas, the crisis facing our nation, to be solved. Now, the other thing is that our struggle over the last decade did very little to grapple with the economic problem that the Negro faces. And let me hasten to say that I say the Negro here, but I'm speaking of all of the poor. I'm not only concerned about the black poor, I'm concerned about poverty among my Mexican-American brothers. I'm concerned about poverty. I'm concerned about poverty among my Puerto Rican brothers. I'm concerned about poverty among my Indian brothers. I'm concerned about poverty among my Appalachian white brothers, and I wish they would realize that we are struggling against poverty for everybody and would join in the movement to get rid of poverty.
It's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
And good morning, and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. Aloha. Hey, I played Dr. Martin Luther King, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, as you know. I'm a big fan of his, and every day I owe respect to him and pay respect in my thoughts, so, and others that have led the way. So anyway, there's a really interesting situation brewing or occurring there in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm sure some of you have heard of Memphis, Tennessee. In fact, this is where Dr. Martin Luther King met the unfortunate, paid the highest price there is in this movement that he was leading, and was his life there in Memphis while helping workers and so refuge workers and others, as many acts in his efforts to seek freedom and gain freedom for many of us, or all of us, I should say. So we're going to be talking about a situation in Memphis, Tennessee, the Kellogg's plant. Kellogg's, as you know, the Kellogg's Corn Flake, Tony the Tiger, they're great. You've heard the commercials and what have you. And so we did reach out to Kellogg to participate in this conversation, but they declined and gave us an official statement, and we will read that or share that with you. But I now have Mr. Ron Baker and Mr. Kevin Bradshaw on the line, and we're going to be talking about this. And please feel free to call in 524-1080, and just a little background. Tuesday, October 22nd, this is taken from the fact sheet for the union that is helping a number of employees that were locked out of the Kellogg's plant. And so this is the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers Union, or BCTGM. So we're going to welcome them on board, and we'll get going with this topic. And I think you'll find it quite interesting. Good morning, Mr. Bradshaw.
Hello?
Yes, good morning. Is this Ron?
This is Ron here, Carol. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. And Kevin, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
All righty. Thank you for joining in with us. Can you just introduce yourselves and give us a little background on what's going on this, if you would? You'd probably do a better job than I could.
Okay. You want to go ahead there, Kevin?
Yeah, I'll go first. My name is Kevin Bradshaw. I'm president of Local 252G Memphis, Tennessee, and we're currently locked out by Kellogg Company for not accepting their last and best offer, which is to cut hourly wages and take away benefits and insurance, because those things have already been negotiated on the master contract that we have, and they want to try to renegotiate them again, and we weren't eligible to do that. So they told us, you know, we couldn't agree to their terms, that they would lock us out, and ultimately we've been locked out since October
22nd,
2013.
Mm-hmm. Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that a little bit. They've been locked out, as Kevin said, as a result of raising at the supplemental level, which is a lot of unions know as local bargaining, those issues which were already settled in 2012 under master contract negotiations. These areas, I mean, in Kellogg tries to explain these things in current terms whenever they're really future terms for them. With respect to one of the key elements of this is that when people retire out, or when people attrition out of the current workforce, that they will hire people into the plant at $6 an hour less than what the top rate is right now, with no benefits and whatever. And quite frankly, you know, using Memphis as in their supplemental bargaining as a means to try to get what they could not extract in master negotiations in 2012. So, and the union does have labor board charges filed on that, Carol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thanks for sharing the various letters, and we'll mention some of them. The mm-hmm. Southern Christian Leadership Conference at the Memphis chapter has actually offered support in written letters, and if you later on feel free to share some of the contents, but
sure.
But how many people are really impacted? It was a little muffled there. In this lockout, I see described as a lockout. You're not striking. You were actually locked out. I want to make sure that was clear. If it's exactly what I read as well.
Yes, 226 people are involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's families included.
And so I read some of the information where now those that are locked out, some of them, or all of them, I guess, are having to face medical bills, and there were illnesses that they had before this. How are they dealing with that?
Let me just say this, Carol, too, with respect to the 226 people, just to add to what Kevin said. It's not only 226 people, it's their families, and also. And, you know, it is. I mean, it's been devastating in that whenever Kellogg cut off, locked the gate behind them, they also, the same day, cut medical benefits to their families. And there were a lot of surgeries scheduled. There were a lot of medical procedures that were scheduled that had to be reshuffled, rescheduled. People are paying out of pocket to have coverage right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Kellogg likes to make the claim that they care about people, they care about their employees. If you look at the W.K. Kellogg legacy and the K values that they call them of Kellogg Corporation, their employees are the number one concern of theirs. Well, in all honesty, what they're trying to do in this Memphis dispute is to kind of hide Memphis under a bushel while they go around, like, still publicly expressing their concern for consumers, their workers, and the communities in which they work.
Mm-hmm. Now, Memphis is pretty much depressed economically anyway, correct?
Yes.
And so how does this play once more jobs? But I did some reading and looking at Memphis, the city of Memphis and its administration extends some nice convenient deals for big companies. Is Kellogg one of those companies that received a deal with the city where they get tax breaks and what have you for bringing in jobs?
Oh, yeah, Ron, I'll let you go ahead and tackle that one also.
Okay. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I mean, we've raised with city council and Shelby County officials that on the books right now is a 15-year pilot program, which is called Payment in Lieu of Taxes, where, you know, and quite frankly, I mean, you know, if done correctly, I mean, you know, those kind of things can work, where, you know, a corporation wants to come in, they give good wages and benefits, those people earn money, they spend in the community, and taxes come, and the ability to perform public services and education actually come as a result of increased employment. But what we have here is a company that still has that on the books as far as tax breaks, and take the very taxpayers that have given them in part the ability to do their business there and lock them out on the street.
Mm-hmm. And how the mayor, I read somewhere in some write-up, the mayor, the Worthington is his name, is he offering support? I saw a city councilman had offered some help, Lee Harris, councilman in District 7. How about the full city council? Are they involved in this, and what is their role?
Well, they received a resolution letter and everything else, and actually tomorrow they'll be, well, not much tomorrow, Tuesday, they'll be putting that resolution to the whole city council and voting up on it. And we'll pretty much know then who we have on our side and who we don't have on our side that's going to support labor in the city of Memphis and stop corporate greed as we speak of. So that's to be determined, mm-hmm. as far as I can say.
Well, if you would allow me to just digress here a bit and say, I want to share this statement. I think it's only appropriate. From Kellogg's that we solicited from them. And basically the response is, here's our response to your question regarding the Memphis plant that should be attributed to Chris Charles, Kellogg Company spokesperson. Quote, Kellogg is concerned that the situation in Memphis is ongoing and would like to see our employees back to work. To this end, we urge our employees to ask their union leaders to resume negotiations by providing the company written proposals and agreeing to set dates to resume bargaining. The plant continues to operate, and we continue to service our customers. Once we agree to a fair and competitive contract, we all can get back to the important business of keeping the Memphis plant moving forward. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'd like to jump in on that a little bit. I mean, it's clearly a public relations statement. To give you an example, here's what they're saying without saying it. They're saying that if the union makes proposals on those same things that we have maintained weren't properly before the supplemental bargaining anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they want. They want the union to do. Now that's like saying, provide to me a proposal that we will use as evidence to show that your initial argument that these were improperly before us is no longer valid.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, terms and conditions of employment for regular employees are contained under the master contract terms. That's wages. That's wages, what people are paid, and their working conditions, and those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, what they want the union to do, and their offer is, come back and talk to us about the same things that you claim you can't talk about, and then we'll be happy.
Mm-hmm.
That absolutely. I mean, I'm not surprised that that's their position because they know that's the subject of the board charges.
I see. Kevin?
Yeah, I agree with Ron saying that that's just a really good trick, if you might say, to get us back to the table so they can bargain the impasse and implement whatever changes they want to change anyway. But, you know, our position is still our position that they're not bargaining in good faith, and it's just a trick to get back to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they've asked for, like Ron stated, has already been negotiated. So to try to get those wages and those benefits and everything taken away or reduced or whatever they want to call it and still be competitive for the market in Memphis is still not fair because you're not paying what you can afford to pay. You're paying what you want to pay based upon the market in Memphis. And that's why we're trying to get Memphis, the city of Memphis and everyone else to understand that this is an attack on labor itself. And it's not just our fight, it's everyone's fight.
So let me ask you this. It's similar to other situations that I've witnessed and read about. Would you care to characterize this? And some have said in some readings that it's the equivalent of union busting or similar. Is that, would you characterize it as that, their actions?
I guess I would. I definitely would, because what this would do, it would cause division. It's a two-tier wage system, what they're actually imposing or trying to propose, a two-tier wage system. And we all know that the oldest strategy in the book is to divide and conquer. And
mm-hmm.
ultimately, that's what this would do. It would be us against them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want equal pay for equal work, and that's all we're asking for.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed in your fact sheet that you shared with me, and I appreciate it, it speaks, company wants casual part-time workers. And then, quote, Kellogg has told its Memphis employees that the cause of the lockout is its desire to use, quote, casual labor in the cereal plant and to introduce alternative work schedules.
Yeah, I'll comment on that, and then, Kevin, you can jump in there. Here in the agreement that they have, we have at Memphis currently, there's a provision in there for casual workers. And the definition of that, Carol, is those are people that are hired to fill in for vacations or fill in for exorbitant amounts of overtime that can't be worked by the bargaining unit employees, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers of those are allowed to be up to 30%. They can't exceed 30% of the total regular employees hired, and they can only be used for those two specific reasons that I outlined. Here's their definition. They keep calling them casuals, but in all honesty, this is a different classification of regular employees, and regular employees' terms and conditions fall under the master contract, but here's what they want. They want 100% to be able to use, without a cap, all the casuals they want, and we'll call them their employees of the future because that's how they've termed those, and as people retire out, they will keep adding to those numbers, and it'll be $22 an hour, no benefits. Now, some people may say, wow, $22 an hour, boy, that's really a lot of money. No medical benefits, no defined benefit pension plan, no pension plan right now that they put anything on the table over, nothing but $22 an hour. Now, when you want to buy your own health care, and you don't have any other terms and conditions of employment, then that $22 in real money really becomes like a $10 or $12 an hour wage. But here's the kicker for this. they want to, then these employees that are casuals, they want to also have a different type of scheduling in the plant. Not traditional, but they'll call alternative scheduling, which they've never even told us what that's going to be. But only those casuals will have the right to bid on those alternative schedules. And if they change the entire plant over toward alternative scheduling, that's the people that just came in the door will have more rights to bid on that work than the ones that have been there 30, 40, and 50 years. So, if they transform the entire plant to alternate production and fill the plant up with casuals, the ones that will be left on the bottom of the heap will be the full-time employees who have no work.
I see.
Kevin, you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, Ron is exactly right. I mean, that's their plan. I agree. It's union busting in its newest form, or not new form, but in their own form. I mean, they've been teaching their management and other people in human resources and everything else to implement this and teach it all over the industry to get rid of the union. They have openly expressed the need to be union free in the future because it gives them more flexibility. Mm-hmm. And what they mean by that, they don't have to pay what they can afford to pay. And they make a lot of money. They'd be able to pay whatever they want to pay based upon the demographics of the market or whatever city they're in. And that's what they want. Ron is exactly right. I agree with him.
Mm-hmm. Now, somewhere I read, and I have to be careful in reading it and taking it to heart to be truth, but maybe you can confirm or shine some light on this. What I read was that there were allegations that the company, Kellogg, had hired a company which brought in workers from Ohio, and they're housing them in a hotel. Is that true?
Yeah, that is very true. That is very true. They brought in workers from Strongville, Ohio, from a company which is now called Appomac, which is known all over the industry as a strike and lockout work release corporate-funded company. And they are housing them in one of the most expensive hotels in Memphis, Tennessee, the Hilton, which is roughly about $169 a night.
And
feed them free meals a day.
How many employees or casual or temporary workers are involved from Ohio?
Well, they're not casual. They're temporary workers. We would guess anywhere from 75 to 100, maybe.
And are they getting the same salary that the current employees that are locked out, or they're paying them less? And if so, how can the company afford to pay the company to recruit these people, transport them, house them? I guess they get per diem, and then in turn pay them a salary? How does that
Well, that's because Kellogg has a lot of money, and yeah, they're paying about $10-$12 an hour. They're feeding them 3 meals a day. They're providing transportation and room and board. So, you know, they will go at any cost to pay out what they want to pay to be able to get what they want in the future. And money is no object to them. So, I mean, there you have it. I mean, they have plenty of money.
Let me ask you this. By the way, Kevin, you probably detected my southern accent. I'm from a little town called Cleveland, Mississippi, straight down Highway 61.
I know exactly where it's at.
And so, we're quite inquisitive in that area all the way in the Delta. We've always inquired. So, again, were there people in Memphis? I'm not supporting what they've done in the lockout, but could the company Kellogg have hired people there in Memphis to do what they've done with people from Ohio? Just being an advocate here, devil's advocate, I should say.
They very well could have, and we do believe that they are hiring some people locally there in Memphis from their different work release programs and everything else that they have within the city of Memphis. But when you try to get hired as a regular employee with any type of felony or whatever, you can't work there. Mm-hmm. But they're hiring felons to replace us. So it's really like, you know, we want you, but we don't want you. But you're good enough to be a temporary worker or a scab, whatever you want to call it.
I see.
So, yeah.
So it suggests that if it's not union busting, it suggests to me that there's some serious questions should be brought on by legislators and other leaders, especially if they're handing tax breaks and calling it an incentive to build jobs, increase employment.
Well, yeah. Carol, if I could add, too, There are. I mean, as a matter of fact, I mean, the letters you see from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, I mean, those aren't the only communications that have gone to Kellogg over time. John Bryant, the CEO of Kellogg, has never answered any of those himself, mm-hmm. which is not surprising to me. Chris Charles makes his statements for him. He's not only the corporate communication person, but I guess he holds a title of director of philanthropic giving or whatever. But mm-hmm. but here's the thing. You know, they pay these people from Ohio or wherever less to work in there. But, you know, in a lot of ways, I mean, not we don't condone that either. I mean, we think it's a low way to make a living. But you know, Kellogg doesn't have any concern for this community at all. I mean, in all reality, I mean, to put those people out on the streets that have 20, 30, 40, and a couple have 53 years of service, just because people will not agree to essentially put themselves and their families at jeopardy and future families in jeopardy in the future. See, this is not only about 226 people that are locked out. This is about the Memphis community, too, and many leaders. And there'll be an announcement this week that there is a new community coalition that's being formed. And people from the religious community, labor, civic, and social have already said and stood up and said, we are not going to allow Kellogg to try to take advantage of this city and its demographics and its work wage and drill it down even further. So, I mean, there's a lot of people that are going to come out and in support of this and to tell the story about exactly what's happening in Memphis.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in the lockout an ultimatum, or the ultimatum. Can you speak to that? Kellogg gave the workers an ultimatum. What?
Yeah, an ultimatum?
Yeah.
The ultimatum was just simply the last and best offer. Is either take what we offer or we'll lock you out. And we'll cut your benefits off the same day, 7 a.m. October 22nd. And that's exactly what they've done.
And was this all, was there a warning? Did they give them preparation or was it just a repeated warning or what have you?
Probably on October the 16th, they notified us that if we didn't accept their terms and conditions by October 22nd, that they would lock us out. But prior to that, during negotiations around by October 10th, they had told us that, you know, we would continue to work through negotiations if we felt like we were getting anywhere. Well, we felt like we TAs tentatively agreed upon everything except for the things that were already agreed upon that we couldn't agree upon. So the company still locked us out.
So, yeah, I was just going to say in their statement to this end, we urged our employees to ask their union leaders to resume negotiations. Apparently you were in negotiations. And
yeah.
They then lock you out, and now I'm trying to make sense of it to sound intelligent here, because it sounds like there's conflict in these statements. There's disingenuous in nature, it seems. But that's just my take on it.
Right, you're right.
So what are other supporters, or you have any other unions involved in helping you with this? And one actually was a little not shocked or taken aback that he had not heard about this, I'm told. But the reality is, I guess you've been involved in this for 4 months now, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And thinking there's light at the end of the tunnel, but now I guess no light, so you're now expanding your efforts? Could we say
Well, Carol, we've always moved this not only in the Memphis community, but also tried to move this outside the Memphis community. I will tell you, you've been around a long time, and, you know, we do know that in a lot of ways, sometimes you have to force the press to tell the right story, to get the facts correct, because they sometimes are reticent about just sitting back and letting things go the way they go. And you just have to keep forcing your message out there until, like, somebody, like, begins to recognize that it's a problem. It's just not an isolated issue. And that's really where we are right now. Quite frankly, and I think you've seen it, the Al Sharpton's organization, the National Action Network, has, like, taken interest in this, because this is not only a labor dispute by a corporation that claims that it's the face of good things and cares about children and cares about the communities or whatever, and actually, like, turning the Al Sharpton's organization has said that they're going to raise it to a national level, if not in the near future of February the 22nd, that there's not some movement to create some semblance of fairness here and return these people back to work.
Mm-hmm. So that's the National Action Network.
Yes, it is.
And I, maybe it's just me reading into this, but it suggests that there's an insensitivity, a great degree of it, on the part of someone at Kellogg's, because they won't answer the Southern Christian leadership. And these are people that are just, we know the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We know that they've been around for many years and have had an active role in civil rights. And you won't bother to answer them either? Now, I know you have legal advisors, and they give you advice not to say certain things, but why not just write and say, we thank you for your letter, and but at this time we have no comments. But to ignore the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, I guess also the National Action Network, did they respond to the city councilman, Lee Harris?
I don't know whether Lee, and Kevin, you could help me with this, but I don't know whether Lee Harris has actually reached out to them, but there are... But I mean, I'm not saying that that won't come in the future, but, you know, to really... You know, the true story behind it is that Chris Charles did respond to the Reverend Montgomery just by saying the first letter, when he said, I really would like to talk to John Bryant so we can talk this thing over. Maybe there's a way to resolve this. The entire first letter that came from Charles, and I can't think about all the words verbatim, but the thing that sticks with me was Chris Charles went on to talk about the philanthropic goodness of Kellogg's to the Memphis community, almost as if to say, look, the money that we've given to certain communities have given us a license to do what we're doing right now. I mean, and actually that's the way Pastor Montgomery took that.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, that's the only response that Pastor Montgomery's got. I think he might have got a second one back from the same person, but never from anyone that is in a decision-making role within the company.
Well, that was my take in reading that, too. I felt as if it was saying, this is what we do for you, and we've done all of these things. And I went away with the sense that they would also be willing to take away that. But that's just my take on it. And by the way, I've put a link at carolcox.com for these letters and other attachments of the fact sheet. But we have a call. Would you folks like to entertain a call?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, sure.
They went away. Anyway, so we'll try to pick them up again. But what's happening is that some of the products, and where their offices or plants are located, and can you share that with us again? I think you alluded to a couple of them.
Yeah, we have four cereal plants in North America, one being Memphis, Tennessee, another being Battle Creek, Michigan, Omaha, Nebraska, and Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And we also have one that's in London, Ontario, in Canada, but they just recently announced it's closing for the year of 2014. And that is ultimately the plan, that they move 43 million pounds of our rice that we make Rice Krispie treats with to, saying that they could run it cheaper than what we ran in Memphis, although we get our rice from Rome, from Arkansas, and ship the rice right to Rome, Georgia. So they figured it was cheaper to ship it from Canada to Georgia. So they took 43 million pounds of rice there, and now they want to bring it back because they propose to get this cheaper rate and lower wages on labor.
I see. So they're looking for benefits and financial favors or strategies, I guess, but they're stripping the workers of
yeah.
anything, I guess, the ones that work.
Yeah, and then another example of that is, and we know that there's issues in the, and just to give you a little background, I mean, we, the BCTGM is also a member of the International Federation of Food Workers. There's 12 million all across the world. The Australians are part of that. Those in the UK are, in Belgium, all across. And we've been working in conjunction with them because this is a multinational corporation. As a matter of fact, John Bryant is from Australia. His vice president and executive vice president of global supply chain is from Great Britain. I mean, in all honesty, the total complexion of the upper realm of this corporation has changed in the last 4 or 5 years. You know, they had a claim and a great claim in the past that they cared about employees, they cared about markets, they cared about the consumers. Actually, the American middle class and consumers in the United States of America and in industrialized country helped create this iconic brand.
Mm-hmm.
Now that they've made it, now that their sales are $14.2 billion with between $1 and $2 billion a year in profits, they've decided that they have turned their back on the same base that has created this brand to begin with. In Australia, the Charmhaven plant's closing. That particular product is going to Thailand, and the average wage in Thailand per hour is $1.13 an hour.
Mm-hmm. Okay, hold on. Good morning, caller. You have a comment or question?
Hello?
Yes, good morning. You have a comment or question?
Yeah, hi, Carol.
Hi.
This is Eric Gill. I wanted to call in. I was urged to listen to this show, and I'm glad I did. I do have a comment or a question, but first of all, I'd like to... Are our two brothers from Memphis still on the line?
Oh, yeah, they're Kevin Bryant and Ron Baker.
Hi, brothers, I had the Unite Here local here in Hawaii, and we are affiliated through the IUF. I just heard you describe that, and I'm very glad to hear about this, and if you don't mind, I'd like to drive a few points in terms of the local parallels to people here in Hawaii.
Be great.
So,
go ahead, Eric.
Assuming that I can do that. First
yes,
of all,
go ahead.
I was impressed, Carol, with the opening speech from Dr. King that you played, because I think the theme of that is very important to this conversation. Dr. King, as we know, was assassinated in Memphis as he was promoting workers' right to be represented by a union, in particular in that case was the refuse workers, I believe. And here again we see a similar attack, and it's an attack to push back what Dr. King was talking about. And I think it's very important for people to grasp that piece of what Dr. King said. He said basically that, you know, many people supported the civil rights movement when they saw, you know, terrible things happening, things that we as a community should be ashamed of, you know, dogs attacking people wanting equality and so on. And he then pointed out that that wasn't enough, that being against bad treatment of certain people is not enough, because you have to go and extend that further and address what actually costs. You know, it doesn't cost anything to let people into the voting booth, but the support of liberals, if you will, or supporters, has to go further than that and has to address the underlying poverty. And then he went on to say that, and he drew the obvious conclusion then, which is that if you're going to attack poverty, you can't attack it on the basis of just one nationality or one ethnic group or one color of people and so on. And in fact, to attack poverty, he demonstrated in practice that the way to do that is to promote workers' ability to work together, join unions, and secure a better future for themselves and for their families, and by extension for the communities they live in. And poverty is very simply defined if you actually add up the numbers, and I haven't done that. I would urge my brothers in Tennessee to do that, because when we do add up the numbers of the amount of money that the Kellogg's proposal and actions is sucking out of the community of Memphis as we speak, you know, and I'm sure that they're paying those scab workers less, and their whole plan is to pay less and to take away hard-won benefits that the people of Memphis have won through their union for medical coverage and pension coverage. And if you actually add the dollar value of all those things up, what you'll see is that there's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that are being sucked out of the Memphis community. And this is happening in Hawaii as well. We received a couple weeks ago a similar last best and final from Kaiser Permanente, where we represent almost 2,000 workers. Mm-hmm. And Kaiser's proposal is to take away those people's pension. And if you add up that and you look and you extend the money that would be sucked out of the community as workers, you know, grow old and retire with nothing, and then have to, you know, basically their families have to put money together to support them, and the communities have to extend Medicaid or other forms of assistance to them. You know, what Kellogg is doing and what Kaiser is doing in Hawaii is attacking the community. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really the point that Dr. King was making. It's not an attack just on these workers, and not only on their families, but on the entire prosperity of the community that that has, you know, through forming unions, has won from this company. And then they turn around and ask for breaks from the same community, just as Kaiser is getting here in Hawaii. Kaiser's getting, you know, millions of dollars of free advertising because they're one of two monopoly corporations providing medical benefits through these state exchanges. And the community of Hawaii has spent millions of dollars to, in essence, promote the Kaiser plan, while Kaiser is turning around and saying to the community, by the way, you know, here's thousands of workers that we propose will not have any pension benefits, so good luck, community, taking care of your elders later on when they retire, because they won't be able to take care of it for themselves. And that puts our members and the workers who are locked out in Tennessee in that terrible situation where, mm-hmm. you know, as they grow old, their families will have to choose between taking care of the parents and or using those same resources to provide opportunities for their children. And ultimately, this is an attack on many generations because, you know, for me as a worker, I don't want my children have to take care of me. I want them to take care of my grandkids. That's why I work so hard. That's why my members work so hard, is to take care of the future and to build a future for their families, and by extension, build prosperity into the community by having their families do better. So also do all the businesses and all the enterprises that are supported by people having money to spend in them. And so if you add up the amount of money that is being sucked out of Memphis, or that Kaiser is proposing to suck out of Hawaii, then, you know, it comes into many, many, many billions of dollars mm-hmm. over time. And so what's most important, I think, here is for us to kind of go back and take a beat and take a pause and ponder on what Dr. King said. And what he said was that, you know, we can't do it together. This is not a struggle of black people or white people or any kind of people. This is a struggle of all people. And to win, we have to all get together. It's not enough to just be, you know, a civil rights movement. We have to link up the civil rights movement with the labor movement so that the civil rights movement can deliver the economics that are vital to people, and not just, you know, rights, which are very important, but are not sufficient without addressing the underlying poverty. And the truth is that unions are the tool that Hawaii's people used, for example, to become a modern economic engine as opposed to a two-crop plantation economy where workers were locked into plantation camps and so on. Mm-hmm. And that Hawaii's people used the tool of unions to create a more just economic society. And that's exactly what the workers in Memphis have done, both in Dr. King's time and today, obviously. But what Kellogg is trying to do is roll it back. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to, in essence, say, well, you know, we're progressive people, but, you know, in essence, pretend to be progressive, and that's what I just heard remarked on, mm-hmm. while simultaneously attacking the communities that have actually extended, in this case, you know, some tax credits or, you know, some other tax incentives. So they'll gladly take what they can from the communities and then take again from the workers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a larger extent, you know, you got to see this as, yes, they're holding those workers hostage and, in fact, are carrying through their threat. You know, we're going to take your medical. We're going to take your job. We're going to put you on the street. And you're not going to have any money. You are going to be threatened by us until you give up those things that you fought for and that your community needs. But in a larger sense, they're also threatening the entire community. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't doubt that if Memphis enacts sufficient laws to try to control the actions of this company, that Kellogg's will then hold the entire community hostage. They'll say, well, if you tell us that, Memphis, we're going to take our plant and go out of town. And in that speculation, that whole conversation was had recently for the Boeing workers up in Seattle, which, you know, Seattle fought hard to keep them, and Boeing was trying to take them off, and here's a company making billions and billions of dollars at the taxpayers' trough, you know, building military hardware and so on, and yet, you know, they have to fight to keep the jobs that they built in Seattle instead of having them take somewhere else. And those workers are still in Seattle, and they just lost their pensions. Mm-hmm. So what we have here is an attack on people, and it comes in the form of an attack on a union in this case, and in our cases, but it's really an attack on the entire community. And the test of the community's response is, do they see this, you know, do people see this as, oh, you know, those poor workers, let's help those poor workers, or do they correctly see it as we are being attacked altogether, and we're all in the union, really. And so I think that's the task for our generation. It's the same task Dr. King put out, but they're rolling it back now, and he was trying to roll it forward. So mm-hmm. I think we as a community and as individuals have to decide, you know, are we going to let them roll back history, or are we going to continue to push forward? And if we push forward, then I think people's conclusion, all kind of people from all kind of occupations and walks of life, has to be, like Dr. King said, let's all get together, let's unionize, and let's use that tool to go and get a better deal.
Right.
And it is true for, you know, that collective bargaining is the best tool to determine what a company can and should pay to the community. But in this case, the company is bringing global money. They're clearly willing to take some losses to drive benefits and wage standards down in Memphis. And, you know, they're basically gathering their capital from all over the world. And I heard it said, and I think it's actually absolutely true. They're pinpointing Memphis. We're going to make a breakthrough here. We're going to bust the union here. We're going to make the union take a losses here. And should they succeed in Memphis, you know, I'm sure that what was said earlier is true. They're going to take that on the road and attack other communities as well. So I'm sorry for going on for so long, but I'm very interested in this conversation, and thank you for the opportunity to participate.
Thank you. We're going to take a break in a bit, but in about 4 minutes. But Kevin and Ron, if you would, you have any comments right now? I'd like to continue this conversation and talk about, in the same vein that Eric is talking, Kellogg puts profit over people. This is a document you shared with me. I guess you folks put this document together. What does Kellogg do with its profits? And
sure.
And I believe we hear that the middle class is eroding daily. But how is it done? No one really go into the greater details. So that's one of the reasons I felt I was attracted to this. It gives an explanation, and with you folk willing to provide that, unfortunately, Kellogg was, you know, but I guess that's par for the course. The less you say, the more you can play, I guess.
Well, that's right, Carol, and, you know, the other thing about it, just to get back to what Eric said, and he's absolutely true, you see, these corporations have changed at the top so dramatically over time. You know, Kellogg enjoys being a U.S. corporation. There's protection in that and everything else, but, and, you know, that's the sole thing that they're concerned about. But these corporations, and Kellogg to boot, especially with the new configuration of its executive leaders, have no ties to this country. No ties to the communities in this country, the workers. The only loyalty is to the dollar and to their and to propping up the price of their stock for shareholders. What they've done with their profits over the last several years is bought back stock to inflate the price for large institutional investors to the tune of $3.85 billion over the last 4 or 5 years. They pay their CEOs as most $6.6 million to Mr. Bryant and multiple millions to others in that upper tier too. So when people ask the question like how can a U.S. corporation do this to U.S. citizens it's because they have absolutely no loyalty whatsoever to a geographic area, to a group of workers. Their only loyalty is to the dollars that they can put on the bottom line, and they don't care if they devastate communities on their way out the door.
Because they can pick up today and move somewhere else because there's always someone willing to improve their economy in this today's economy.
Well, that's true, and that's even happened on the local level. If you take folks that make $22 or that had good wages and benefits, and you put them on the street, and you hire somebody for 10 to 12, and in all reality, if you think about it, as much as we don't like that to happen, these people are being exploited too, and once they're done with them, quite frankly, they'll look for an $8 to $10 an hour group to exploit.
Wow. Eric, are you able to join us after we come back from a break?
Sure.
Great to have you.
Stay on the line or call back in?
Either way, it's going to take us about 7-8 minutes after we go off air here the first hour. But
I'm happy to wait. Thanks for the opportunity.
And the listeners out there, you can join in 524-1080, and you can pick this up podcast about 20 minutes after we go off air at carolcox.com, or you can stream it now live if you're willing to go to carolcox.com. My guest is Ron Baker, a strategic campaign coordinator for the BCTGM, or Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers, and Mr. Kevin Bradshaw, the local union there of the same group, and Eric Gill from Unite 5 here in Honolulu. So we'll take a break, and we'll be right back, okay?
Concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain.
And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried.
Stay tuned for the second half of the Carol Cox Show right after the news on KWAI Honolulu, K101 Radio. Time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now here's Carol.
Good morning and welcome back to the Carol Cox Show, or should I say aloha. We're discussing a matter in a workers' lockout in Memphis, Tennessee by the Kellogg workers. Kellogg's company, I should say, and my guest is right now is Mr. Ron Baker, strategic campaign coordinator for the BCTMGM, and Mr. Kevin Bradshaw, and we also have Mr. Eric Gill
also on the line here, local Unite 5. So, gentlemen, thank you for joining me again, and thanks for waiting. So go ahead and take up where you were. I wanted to discuss a little bit about the document here you shared with me, Kevin and Ron, about profits and the use of profits, and you were speaking to that before we went off air the first hour.
Well, you know, the company has made great profits over the course of time, and what they've been doing in recent past is they started back, I believe, in about 2008-2009 with a program called K-Lean. And what K-Lean was a way to reduce the number of employees that they have. I mean, it was a headcount reduction is what it amounted to. And so, I mean, you know, the profits that they make, they are engaged in buybacks of their own stock. I mean, I think in 2010 it was like $1 billion or something like that they dedicated to it. But over a five-year period, $3.85 billion got taken out of the company to buy their own shares back, inflated the stock prices for large institutional investors, and I'm sure that makes them happy, which gives them favor with the board, which gives those institutional investors favor with the corporate CEOs and the people in Battle Creek. Then they roll out these efficiency programs, and the last one that they rolled out was Project K, which is part of these the London, Ontario downsizing, the Charm Haven downsizing. I mean, you can call it what you want. It's a move to consolidate their business, and quite frankly, in the Memphis case to decrease wages at places that are currently operating under agreements, and in other places shutting them down and moving those assets to either non-union facilities or to low wage third world countries where they will produce this stuff. So as Eric said, I mean, it's all in an attempt to squeeze every particular dollar they can out of the very communities that built this company into the iconic brand that it is today.
Mm-hmm. Well, from this document that you shared with me as a bullet points, you say that $6.6 million in 2012 for CEO Bryant, $55 million to compensate its CEOs in the last past 6 years. And then you go on to say in this document, $1 billion. The 2010 buyback program cost Kellogg's $2.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking lots of money.
Yes.
And before we go any further, so that the listeners, we're not just talking about cornflakes here, are we? What other products do they make?
Yeah, I'll let Kevin go through that. They make a myriad of other products.
Yeah, if you could, so that the listeners don't think it's just that we're picking on Tony the Tiger or defacing his character, but there are many other products, so how do you make that $14 billion, and then how do you turn into the community, which you've gotten benefits, tax breaks, and then you strip that community and lock them out? I know it's their prerogative, but I'm just curious. But go ahead, Kevin, if you could share some of the companies or products that they manufacture.
Well, some of the products they manufacture is not only cereal, we know that, but you have Sunshine, you have Cheez-It, you have Famous Amos, you have Morning Star, you have Pringles, you have Eggo Waffles, you have Austin Crackers. I mean, it's a long list of different products that could be named here that we were talking about. Yeah, they not only made that money off of cereal, although cereal is the foundation of the company, they made it through other different, subsidiaries or brands or whatever you want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to add about Pringles, too, I mean, I think it was about maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago right now, they paid $2.7 billion for that company. So that's another area they bought out. They bought Pringles outright.
Mm-hmm. And then you also have Keebler.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I just thought I'd share that, and then Raisin Bran, is it Raisin Brands, or what is the...
They make that, yep.
Sugar Pops or something. I don't know all the... in fact, I went shopping looking for those, but it sure would be nice if they could participate, but I guess that's the way life is. But go ahead, guys, and help yourself on as far as what you want to express.
Well, on the consumer side of this, I mean, you know, we have members that work in all in most of these facilities. I think worldwide, I'd be taking a guess, but I think they have 10,000 to 15,000 employees worldwide. Part of their Project K plan is to reduce their global workforce by 7%, which amounts to 2,300 roughly people over the course of the next year. You know, a lot of these things, too, you know, job losses. I mean, it's just like in Australia and at Charm Haven and also in London, Ontario. I mean, these are jobs lost to unionized production, but they're not jobs lost. They're jobs transferred either to non-union facilities or, in the case of Charm Haven, to a facility that they've erected in Thailand. And, of course, they also have a facility in Mexicali, Mexico, that also makes Frosted Flakes, too.
Mm-hmm. We have a call, if you would. Let's see if we can entertain. Good morning, caller. You have a comment or question?
Yeah, I'd like to actually leave a comment. I don't really exactly know where to grab this greased pig at. But I will add, when I listen to Hesh and he talks about good food and stuff like that, even though I like Eggos, everything that Kellogg's makes is poison in our food chain. So I think you're really arguing about something that I just don't even know what to say anymore, but I'll offer that today. Thank you.
Okay, Curtis. Thank you.
Aloha. Go ahead, guys.
Carol, can I break in again?
Yes, go ahead.
I'd like to offer something that I'm sure is going to be a little controversial with your audience and possibly with my union brothers, because I heard the description of the company's position and the impact that it will have. And so I'm very familiar with this because, you know, obviously we deal with similar issues. But when you sum up what the impact of this proposal will be in terms of people's jobs and their schedules, it's an attack on the 40-hour week of full-time employment.
Mm-hmm.
And in essence, what I'm hearing is that the company's proposal over time would replace full-timers with casuals and, in fact, would break the 40-hour week by making full-timers, senior workers who have up to now had set schedules and the ability to have a 40-hour week, make them bid at a disadvantage with new people, and that the workforce will be filled up with casual workers over time. And, you know, there's obvious implications to that that were pointed out. You know, this would create a two-tier, which breaks up workers, so how are they going to fight back, you know, in the next contract to protect senior workers? If the senior workers would accept this, then new hired workers would see that they've been, in essence, put on a double standard, which makes it hard to get people together to fight. But there's another, the controversial implication I would offer here is that this is an attack also by the government, and specifically by the federal government, because if you look at the provisions of the new health care law, and it actually promotes the part-timization of the workforce by making it profitable for companies to do that. And to the extent that Kellogg is able to get workers down below a 30-hour week, then they will have the opportunity and the encouragement to basically push those workers over to these state exchanges and put them on their own, not with no group to protect them or to be part of a risk pool that's larger than a single person. Workers would then be on their own with the health insurance market and would be exposed to exploitation in that regard. So I think one of the uncomfortable things, you know, and I'm going back to what Dr. King said, you know, you can't win a labor struggle unless you overcome, you know, ethnic divisions and bring people of all nationalities and all origins together to fight together in the common interest. So I think it's a particular struggle for workers and many others who, you know, fought hard to elect this president to contemplate that this new law actually can be used and is being used to attack their health care. And so, you know, we have to be able to put things in perspective and see the broader implication. And this is happening to our members as well. We've lost employer-sponsored health care in several communities around the country where basically the companies say, okay, great, now we've got state exchanges, you don't need us anymore, and they just divest the workers who have employer-sponsored health care.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening here. You know, those workers that have health care are the senior workers, and the new hires, the new casuals, do not have health care, and they're going to try to force the senior workers out of their health care by breaking their 40-hour week, which then opens the door to this law. So I think, you know, we all, I, you know, the president was born here in Hawaii, where he grew up. The apartment is, you know, two blocks from my office. I think all people of Hawaii, you know, are proud that we have a president that came from Hawaii. And, you know, so for us as Hawaii people or for African-American people across the country, you know, the question is, how are you going to rise above that and look at what amounts to an attack on all workers being done here,
mm-hmm.
and put it in correct perspective. So what I've seen is, you know, we've all been treated to a 3 or 4 year spectacle where the debate over health care is supposedly between the Democrats and the Republicans, and everybody's screaming and shouting, you know, but at the end of the day, corporations are benefiting in both cases. And so we can't be lost in the illusion here that this is something like a Democrat versus Republican issue.
And we've got to look deeper and see what the impact on working people and, by extension, everybody.
Large companies influencing, big businesses actually influencing, correct? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the healthcare law was written by insurance companies, and they will profit, you know, there's trillions of dollars of public money that's going to be transferred over to insurance companies in the process of this new healthcare system that's really not a new system. It's a public subsidy to the existing system. And so we all have to confront that, and we're going to have to confront it sooner or later. And the first thing to me is for people to understand what's going on clearly and not be fooled into some Democrat versus Republican, you know, shadow boxing charade, and look deeper at actually what this law means for working people. And I would submit that working people is not defined as union members, and working people that have union contracts were the American middle class. Mm-hmm. And the middle class is being decimated because those contracts are being decimated and those jobs are being lost. I just heard a recitation of how Kellogg has moved so much of its production into other countries to, you know, basically to do two things, you know, to hold us hostage, to, you know, in this case very clearly, you know, they will hold out the notion that if you don't agree to this over time, Memphis and union and workers and citizens, will take your jobs and send them somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so they're holding us hostage, and we've got to have a much broader movement that isn't just union workers, and it isn't just people of any particular color, or we have to have a class-wide movement. You know, working people are all of us. Everybody I know, everybody I've ever met, really, with very few exceptions that I have to deal with at the bargaining table, are working people. They get up in the morning, they work, and they go home to their families, and regardless of the jobs and so on, everybody has similar aspirations. We all want the best for our kids, and we want to build a future for our grandkids, and we want our communities to be healthy places where people can grow up and be healthy and be safe and have a better life than we have. That's what motivates people, and that's the opposite is what's happening. And so that's a terrible challenge to us, but it offers also an opportunity, because mm-hmm. the only way we can meet this challenge is by spreading out and not just being union versus management, and it's not just Memphis versus Kellogg. I mean, it's broader than that, and the only solution is to go broader than that. I noticed that the Kellogg workers in Memphis, you guys are affiliated with the IUF, as we are. That's the International Federation of Food Workers, and the truth is, if we don't get effective cooperation and coordination between workers in the United States with workers in Australia and workers in Mexico and different countries, you know, in essence, we won't be able to have enough power to deal with these companies that have lost their geographic roots and are basically global predators. So I think that, you know, the good thing about the situation is, and I think this whole program is a reflection of that. Workers in Memphis can't just treat this as a union and management dispute, and if they continue to do it, or you didn't do that, you're obviously doing a lot more than that. You're reaching out to the community, you're reaching out to the political leaders, you're reaching out through Al Sharpton's network to a broader base of civil rights and good thinking people that are affiliated with that. And that's all right. That's exactly right. But again, you know, the problem is we haven't been able to do more of that. We haven't been able to institutionalize that. We haven't been able to build an effective organization that can build power between very different communities like Memphis versus, you know, not versus, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
how do you link Memphis workers up with workers in Hawaii? How do the Kellogg workers who are being asked to give up their pensions going to effectively coordinate action with our members at Kaiser who are being faced with the same thing and a last, best, and final as well? So the task is very much what Dr. King said at the start, you know, and he was speaking in the broadest possible terms. But this is the broadest possible terms. I mean, we're talking about a movement that has to be much, much broader than any particular locality or even any particular nation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's necessary because the people we're dealing with don't have a nation. Kellogg's pretends to be an American company, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Kaiser pretends to be a nonprofit, you know, and not. I mean, they made $9 billion last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to move beyond that. And I really, what I like about this whole conversation is that's what it's about. And what Dr. King said is exactly points the way forward for us.
Yeah. Can you hold one second? We have a caller, and thanks, caller, for waiting. We'll get right back. Caller, go ahead real quick. You have a comment, a question?
Hi, Carol, everybody there. You know, this is such an important thing. The 40-hour work week, I remember, you know, I mean, we just took it for granted. We had a 40-hour work job, and we got overtime, and that was our bonus. And we got bonuses besides that, you know. And that was just taken for granted. That's the way it is. But from my understanding, a lot of this generation are having to work, you know, two or three jobs, 20 hours here, 20 hours there. 10 hours here, and that's crazy. And of course,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's not even a possibility of getting overtime and any kind of you know, a bonus to your, you know, to your standard of living and
right.
With that. So, and I think somehow the labor folks really, you know, labor union really have to get noted, you know.
Okay.
And, well, anyway, I'd like to hear the comments.
All right. Well, thank you for your comments there.
Yeah.
Aloha.
Yeah, anyway. If I could comment on that, too. I mean, that's one thing that Kellogg's has used on the rare event when they do speak to the press. They say, well, you know, some of the folks that work at this Kellogg plant, some of them make six figures. Well, you know, there is a reason for that because... way back, and Kevin can help me with these numbers, years ago, probably 10, there was like 500 people there. 5 years ago, there was 400 people there. Up until a year and a half ago, there was 300. Now there's 226. So they continue to expect the same, or roughly the same output with fewer and fewer people on the shop floor. And how do you get that? You get that by making sure that people like work continuously. And the one thing about the Memphis plant, a lot of these people work 28 and 2, 28 straight days and then 2 days off in order to keep up with the expectation on production that Kellogg has put there. Now, Kellogg will say, oh, you know, people make a lot of money. Now, they make a lot of money because you've downsized the workforce to the extent that a few have to work so much, but in all reality, it's a benefit to Kellogg because they're not paying two people to do the job that one's doing. They're paying one person to do it, and they're actually having to live at the plant in order to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Kevin, you can help me on those numbers of what those were there in the last, at least the last 5 years.
Yeah, the last 5 years. Well, actually, we were at 800 people in the late 90s. And they did an ad hoc. They downsized the plant to half. And that went to about maybe four or five. And then, you know, like you said, through the years, now we're down to 226. But we're actually running more now than we ran when we had 800 people. And the reason for that, like you said, is mandatory overtime, the 28 and 2. And, you know, we have some people that have worked 157 days straight with no days off. And now the company has just found a better way to even get cheaper or more bang for that buck by reducing the wage and bringing in people at a lesser rate with no benefits and no insurance.
Wow.
And I agree. I mean, they're taking advantage of this, you know, the Affordable Health Care Act and everything else that any kind of way they can just to get more cash on hand to justify or get back the money that they spent on Pringles and the stock buyback program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just to also make another comment based on what Eric had said, you know, you put some real numbers to this. I mean, just on the wage side alone, going from, without considering benefits or vacation time or whatever that the current regular full-time people make when they're in there, I mean, it's a reduction of $12,800 on a straight time basis, okay, per employee, not counting you know, no medical benefit, no meaningful pension plan or any at all, and those type of things, which we know can add up to 40% or 30 to 40% on the hourly wage. So that's their deal, and if they can get it in Memphis, they'll shop it around to the cereal, then they'll shop it around other places, and it'll be like, well, you know, these folks here did it, so you're going to have to do it too. So you got to draw a line in the sand and try to come out with some fair middle ground here, where we're not bargaining over the same things that we bargained and put to rest in 2012,
mm-hmm.
where they didn't get what they wanted and now decide to try to do it at a level that is, in our opinion, not permissive.
Right. Hold on one second here. Caller, good morning. You have a comment or question, please?
Yes, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
I would like very much if Eric or one of your guests will tell us the history of the union, because listening to the last caller, I don't think they understand that the weekend was not in the Constitution. The weekend was given to us by the unions. The middle class was given to us by the unions, and everybody benefited. And I don't think that people this generation know that. So if Eric is good at this, if one of your guests can tell us that, so people understand what is at stake here.
Okay, okay. Guys, go ahead.
I would love to take that. Hi, Marsha.
Hi.
So, look, you know, working people died for the 8-hour day and the 40-hour week. And the American labor movement, it was American workers who led that movement across the whole world. The 8-hour day movement was a 30, 40 year struggle that working people had, and the most famous incident is the so-called Haymarket Massacre, where basically a gathering of workers that were fighting for the 8-hour day was attacked, and the leaders of the demonstration were subsequently executed, some of them. And so it was a, you know, the 8-hour day and the 40-hour week was a basic demand and was successfully pursued by previous generations at the turn of the last century. And so here we are where ultimately, if you look at it from that point of view, what is currently going on is an attempt to push working people, and again, working people is everybody. The middle class was workers who made enough money to have a decent life. That was the middle class. And that class has been destroyed as working people have lost their ability to make enough money to have a decent life. And here we see it playing out in action, where the company will turn around after, you know, if they can win this fight, the company will turn around and say, look, we've just added so many more jobs. Look how many more jobs, how many more people we can employ now that we've managed to pay them nothing and make them, you know, on their own for their future and for the health care and so on. And so what's happening here is an attempt to turn the clock back, not just 10 years or 15 years or 20 years or 50 years. We're talking about turning the clock back to the 1800s in terms of what working people can expect and hope for and build their lives around. And so here we are again. You know, I really, you know, I was so impressed because, you know, Dr. King, you know, years ago kind of pointed the way forward, and here we are being dragged back into the past.
Unwillingly.
Right.
Yeah.
One thing that W.K. Kellogg, when he created the company, I mean, you know, one of his famous lines was, I will invest in my people, in their skills, in their training, in their communities. And that philosophy is what built Kellogg. Now, with the advent of new leadership at Kellogg, I mean, they claim that they have 3 decades of work on child hunger and nutrition, while 226 families that were their employees for 20-plus years every day struggled to feed their children. I mean, it's absolutely and totally hypocrisy. They tried to hide Memphis under a bushel while they trot around the globe and yell from the tallest towers what a great employer they are, what great humanitarian values that they have, and hope that no one looks under the bushel. And quite frankly, we're here to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to look under that bushel.
Mm-hmm. Now, you... Go ahead.
I was just saying I agree with Ron Harvey on that.
Mm-hmm. One of you were talking about the price of corn that they, and I, it caught my attention, where they pay so much per pound for corn, but at the end of the day, a box of flakes is in ounces.
Yeah, Kevin can go into that a little bit. I think they'd be best for that.
Right. Actually, what they're trying to get is, you know, and they want to say that they have to get these wages to be competitive in the market. Well, they're ahead of the market. I mean, the cost of labor associated with one box of cereal is less than 10 cents a box. So every box of cereal you buy, it only takes 10 cents out of that purchase to pay our salary. When I say our salary, not only the 226 workers in Memphis, but it's approximately about 1,500 cereal workers in the United States. So out of every box of cereal you buy all over the world, it takes 6 cents, less than 10 cents, maybe 6 or 7 cents, to pay our salaries, and that's everything with benefits, insurance, and all. So there's no way you can justify what you're trying to do. You're just doing it because you want to and you think you can.
Eric?
Yeah, Carol, look, I that's all exactly true, and I'm sure that number includes more than just the factory workers. Obviously, there are, you know, people in trucks that have to transport the grain. There's a whole supply chain that isn't just working in the plant. So it, you know, there are many other jobs affected, you know, directly or indirectly by this.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can, I'd like to offer kind of a hopeful note. This kind of situation, you know, is a terrible situation, and it can look, you know, doom and gloom because, of course, you know, what we see is, you know, workers, you know, union after union and worker after worker is being forced to take these huge losses. And we saw it playing out here in Hawaii, you know, as, you know, well, for example, Kaiser just laid off 23 more people, you know, and they're claiming that they're improving patient care, you know, and so we see it playing out in every industry. And what's most shameful to me is that we as a community buy into this, and here in Hawaii we've actually attacked our own employees. We've mm-hmm. asked our teachers to take pay cuts. The people that we place our hopes in these people for the future of our kids, and we attack them, and we took benefits and pension and other, you know, we make them, anyway, it's crazy, you know, that the community has been so befuddled by illusions and whatever that we're not even seeing what we ourselves are doing to ourselves. You know, taking away money from a teacher or from a public employee, the guy who picks up the garbage or, you know, fixes up the buildings that we collectively own, that takes money out of the community. And there's no mystery why the state has a revenue problem. I'm sure Tennessee has similar problems as Hawaii, where, you know, the states and the municipalities are losing the ability to provide services to us because their tax base is being eroded, and this is calculable and we can see it. So it's a terrible situation where we've lost touch with what is important. And what's important is for our communities to have sufficient wealth so that we can have secure and safe lives, and we're cutting our own throats.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a terrible situation. But the hopeful part of this is, and I want to put this carefully because I think most people don't get it, and I've heard about the institutional investors. You know, I've heard that mentioned by my brothers, you know, a number of times. And we're dealing with the same thing in the hotel industry and so on. And what you're seeing but what you're talking about now is institutional investors. This is not big rich people.
Mm-hmm.
The institutional investors we're talking about is public pension funds. It's college endowments. It's public money. Money that is not owned by any private individual, but is basically, owned by, you know, communities. You know, and so we in the hotel industry are faced with a company like Blackstone, which is the biggest owner of hotel rooms. But Blackstone really doesn't own those rooms. The Western Conference of Teamsters has $500 million in there, and the California Public Workers have $1 billion in there. And so what we're seeing here is this very strange thing where our own public assets, you know, the retirement, the fund to fund our people's retirement, is being invested in companies and turned by these manager people that are basically hired by us, you know, working people in the aggregate to manage these funds for us, and those individuals turn around and use that money to attack people's pensions. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. But the hopeful aspect of this is this is not the money of those Australian people or whoever they are that are currently running Kellogg. And it isn't about them being Australian or any other country. They're hired hands for the institutions that have given them public wealth, and they're trying their best to scrape off as much as they can in the transaction, and the people are suffering all over the country and all over the world from this. You know, the predation they're doing in the United States. We at least have unions to fight back and to tell us what's happening in Memphis. You know, can you imagine what they're doing in countries like, you know, China or Vietnam or India or those other places?
Oh, yeah.
They're taking business too. So we have a real problem, but it's a problem that has a solution, which is we've got to take back control of our own assets as people, as working people. You know, the California teachers helped us in our fight with Hilton a few years ago to defend our contract and defend our the standards of living for Hawaii's people. And they called up their pension fund and they said, don't use my money for this.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very telling. It was a big instruction. The way forward is for us to break down some perception that unions are something out there, and union and management, that's between those people. And if we can break that down and make people understand that it's not like that, that unions are the tools of all of us, and in fact, management now is misusing the assets of all of us to break us down and to force us into poverty. And so the key here is, how do we take back control of the public assets? And I was really interested in that regard when, you know, a few months ago, Elliot Spitzer, you know, the former governor and attorney general of New York, and of course, you know, he had a little controversy that I'm pretty sure was whipped up by his political enemies, and I saw him on Stephen Colbert, and Colbert is asking him, he says, Elliot, what are you doing here? What, you were governor of New York, you were attorney general of New York, why are you running for controller of New York City? What's a controller? And Spitzer said, look, as a governor, I made laws to kind of control these predators, you know, to bring corporate activity into some sort of a socially responsible role. And as attorney general, I went out and I enforced those laws. But what he said is, as controller of New York, there's, what, $350, $400 billion of assets owned by the people of New York. And he says, I don't have to make a law, and I don't have to regulate a law. I'm just not going to give them the money.
Just hold the purse strings, huh?
Yeah, and we can do that as a community. We can do that if we can get the power to elect the right people who will be listening to working people who actually elect them, and not just listening to all these, you know, shady managerial people who are misusing public assets to bribe us. I mean, mm-hmm. The truth is, you look at the corporations and, you know, the Koch brothers and all that money and stuff, and it's like there's, you know, but that's not, most of that is not even their money, and they're using our own money to screw us.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using our money to bribe our elected officials to allow them to screw us. And the key here is, let's take back control of our money.
And doing that, let me ask you, are you considering to ask the consumer to be discreet in buying these products?
Well, yeah.
Is there discretion? Is that, some call it boycott. Will you be employing, if things continue this way, will you, Kevin and Ron, will you be asking the public to use their discretion in buying Kellogg products?
Well, actually, Carol, let me just say this. It's been the public that is, and in one of the letters that you have there from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, says in that letter, and I'll just try to do it from memory, it basically asks Kellogg to engage in a fair discussion, to come to a resolution of this lockout. And it says in there that short of doing that, that other groups that are in the communities, you know, will move to create their own remedies for this. And one of those that we've heard talked about many, many times is not buying Kellogg's products. And, you know, in that letter it says that, you know, the union and the company can come to some agreement if that he believes, but left undone, I mean, the community and community activists or whatever will take things in many ways into their own hands, and neither of the principal parties to this will have, to a large degree, any control over it. And, you know, there has been discussions about that with the community groups. You know, we have other people that are working for Kellogg right now that, the groups on the ground have identified ways to be able to look and identify a Memphis-produced product. And to move at first on the Memphis produced product that's being done by the those replacement workers in there.
I see.
Carol, you know, we've done a lot of boycotts, and you may recall we did a 3-year boycott against the Hyatt Hotel here and across the country, and boycotts are a very valuable tool, and they also are very difficult in order to actually make them effective. It takes a lot of work and a lot of people working together. And when it came down to it, we had boycotted Hyatt hotels in different communities and particular hotels, and we told people don't come to the Hyatt Regency Waikiki and so on. And there's quite a few right-thinking people that will respond to a boycott like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that, you know, these companies work in such volumes that, you know, moving the dial on the economics is difficult. And you know, if you take $1 million, $2 million, $3 million out of one market, you know, they're turning over billions and billions. And you know, these companies see that as an investment. You know, that's how Safeway saw it in Southern California when they locked out all those grocery store workers. They saw it as an investment. They said so publicly. We're going to invest in our future. We're going to take a couple $1 billion loss to secure a better cost structure for our future growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we have to go beyond just a, you know, community boycotts, although I think, you know, I'm glad to hear the Reverend, you know, talking like that. But boycotts are easier to declare and harder to actually wield. But when we finally won our fight against Hyatt, it was when the boycott became a general debranding, if you will. And mm-hmm. basically we were able to project in various countries. We had Indian workers picketing the Hyatt and Filipino workers picketing the Hyatt. And we were doing a global demarketing campaign, which basically, you know, put a stench in people's minds, not about any particular product, but against the corporation itself. And they pay many, many billions of dollars, and it's been referred to many times in this conversation. You know, they spend a lot of time spiffing up their public image, and that public image can be turned around. Tony the Tiger, yeah. I mean, Tony the Tiger is biting Memphis people in the ass or whatever. I'm
mm-hmm.
sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
But I think the tools are there for workers in Memphis and for the local union there. The IUF, you know, does this kind of thing. I think, you know, there's organizations like ours that have some experience and some ability to share that. And, this is a terrible thing, but it's not just Kellogg's, and that's part of the problem. If you put together all the corporations that are doing this, you'd have a list of all the corporations. And so we've got to be able to move beyond just debranding and fighting single corporations. Like I said, if we as working people in the general, far beyond union members or people that punch a clock, I mean, working people, small store owners work really hard. You know, they get up every day and work, you know, long hours. The working people is a broader category, and it's our money. It's our money, the taxpayers' money. You know, the rich people don't pay taxes. They get politicians to give them tax breaks. So if you're talking about the taxpayers, you're talking about working people, and it's working people's taxes that are in these funds, and these funds are for the benefit of our employees. And why do we allow our assets to be used in this fashion? You know, we can debrand Kellogg, and I hope we do, and I'm happy to help. But if we take the money away from them, or we get the investors who are really, you know, if you look at the California public employees, or the, you know, I'm just using them as an example because they're the biggest. But, you know, if those trustees had the knowledge and the ability to basically tell the money managers, we're not going to give you money for Kellogg.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them have ethical investment policies already on the books. And they already have policies in those funds about what they're supposed to do and not do with that money. And those policies are largely not addressed unless somebody goes and shakes the tree and says, look, you know, mm-hmm. what are you doing? That's against your own policy. And so I would urge my brothers in Memphis and everybody else, let's go to the source. You know, Dr. King pointed the way. But in his day, investors were largely private. And that's changed a lot, you know, since, you know.
Shareholders
since,
and what have you. But, yeah. You know, it does not make much sense when a city or state gives tax breaks to a company and that company has employees, and then the company start to shave away the number of employees and cut back on their salaries and benefits. Who is the city going to tax to give the tax breaks to? Where are they going to get the money from? If the employees of that company now is being dwindled and cut down in their salaries, where is the city going to get its tax money to fix the roads and keep the infrastructure up? Doesn't make sense, or am I looking at it from an extreme point?
No, you're not looking from an extreme position. As a matter of fact, not only taking into account the people that are locked out and not paying their taxes as they would on earned income, but quite frankly, I mean, if a corporation gets away with drilling down and pushing down wages, then you know that the next company is going to see that as an opportunity to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So incomes become reduced, tax on that income becomes reduced, and further stress on educational programs, further stress on community service, further stress on public safety, and all those particular items. You know, Eric said, said something about, you know, taking control of our own money or whatever, but and I agree. But there's also, for any business to succeed, they need stability of markets. They need people and economies that have disposable incomes to buy their products. They need a society that is open to the purchasing of their products. And, you know, events like Memphis, I mean, transcending in different areas of this world. The United States or North American continent and the United States, the North American continent, actually consumes 30% of the world consumables. Now, if you continue to ratchet down benefits, wages, living standards all across the globe like this, then it won't matter whether Kellogg makes it for $1.13 or an hour or 22, because there won't be people that are in a position with disposable income to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why all this is a short-sighted kind of like what I would put the last man standing club. How much can I wring out of this false economic vision that I have before the bottom falls out everywhere?
Mm-hmm. Hold on 1 second, gentlemen. We're going to close down in a few minutes and give you a couple of last minutes here.
Caller, good morning. Thank you for calling. You have a comment, a question?
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. Three very quick books exactly about what you're speaking by Noam Chomsky. One is Profit Over People. The other one is Media Control. The third one, Propaganda and the Public Mind. Walter Lippmann in the 20s wrote about the Propaganda Commission, how to manufacture consent, how to limit the bewildered herd, and all for the specialized class, all for the elite. You had the Wagner Act in 35, you had in 37 the Johnstown Steeler Strike, you got the Mohawk Valley Formula, And if I had more time, I could try to help you a little bit with the history. Thank you very much for taking my call, and it's an excellent, excellent program.
Thank you. And, gentlemen, go ahead. Again, we got about four more minutes, and I do want to offer, can we do this again? Because if you got other people out there, can you just consider this these 2 hours, make them available, if you can assemble something, I think, to get the discussion going?
I certainly can. I think that I think Kevin can also, right, Kevin?
Oh yeah, I'm available.
Okay, well, if you folks can arrange something, pick up a couple people, others that you think can contribute. I'd be happy, and anytime you think it'll help, I'm really interested in providing this airtime for you.
And we appreciate you.
But go ahead and take a minute of each of you, if you would. We're down at the last few minutes, so.
Well, I'd like to first say I appreciate being on the show. I think the first thing that people could do to listen to the broadcast to help, you can definitely look at any box of cereal or any Kellogg product you have and call that 1-800 number and tell them and address your concerns about, you know, how they're doing their Memphis employees and how they have them locked out, and let them know what you plan to do and how you feel about it. I think that'll be a good call on our behalf.
Okay. And they can see other Google some things. I noticed that it wasn't much national coverage on this, the media. Can you, real quickly, either of you, share your insights on that?
Well, I only say that there is, as of the middle of January, I think that you will see here in the very near future national media outlets that begin to pick this up. You know, a lot has been done, and a lot of people have viewed this in a different light, other than it being just a Memphis-based dispute. And I think, Carol, you'll find in the next several weeks that there'll be more national attention on this particular issue.
Okay, Eric.
Look, I'm delighted. I did not know about this, but I'm delighted that through this means I've learned about this struggle, and through this conversation I've seen so many links between what the people of Memphis are facing and what the people of Hawaii are facing. So I think coming out of this, you know, we should make those links. We should point that out to people here in Hawaii. What's being done to us is the same thing that's being done to them, and we're all in this together. And in fact, the only solution to the problems for the people of Memphis and our own people here is to find a way to together take back control over what is ours and to basically follow the direction that Dr. King laid out decades ago. So thanks for this opportunity.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Eric, for being on here. I appreciate it. This is Ron.
Okay.
Yeah, we appreciate this, Kevin.
So what's next, gentlemen? You have anything we should be looking forward to in the coming days, weeks? Or if you get an announcement, you think you'll be?
We will certainly, as part of this, keep you updated on what's going on with the dispute. I mean, every time we make a connection, we make sure that those people are on the list for future updates and those kind of things. I think I can speak for Kevin. We're there one day longer than it takes to, like, get justice here in Memphis.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Carol, would you be willing to assist? I'd like to exchange information with my brothers there, but we don't need to make the...
Go ahead. Help yourself.
Well, no, I think that to the extent that you are able to communicate directly with us, we would be happy to receive such communications.
Yeah,
our website domain is unitehere5.org, five numeral five. So if we can receive that, then I think we will, you know, this is not charity. We're not doing, you know, we wouldn't be assisting you guys out of some charity, but rather the sense that we're all in this together, and your fight is our fight. And if we can make the people of Hawaii see that and realize that, then we'll all be stronger together.
Right. You can also see on the BCTGM's website at bctgm.org, and new updates are posted continuously.
Okay.
Hey, Carol, maybe in the future, maybe some of our Kaiser workers might be willing to sit in, and maybe a couple of the locked out workers in Memphis, I think that would be very interesting to hear from people on the ground exactly how this confrontation feels in our different places with the same fight.
Well, I just consulted my producer, and they said that if you'd like to do that next week or the week after next, we can do it. Your choice. If you want to do it next week, I'd be happy to entertain it, and there's 2 hours available.
Well, let me rustle up the folk, and we'll be in touch.
Already.
We will, too.
Well, gentlemen, thank you. I want to thank all of you for joining in, and we try to do the best here, so I appreciate your time, and keep us informed, and let's shoot for next week if you like to. I'm all ears and anxious, so. I'm a Mississippi boy, so we get things done. All righty. Thank you, guys. Aloha.
Thank you. Aloha.
Aloha. Aloha. All righty. I want to thank my guest there, Mr. Ron Baker, Strategic Campaign Coordinator for the Confectionery Tobacco Workers and Grain Millers Union, and Kevin Bradshaw, and also Mr. Eric Gill of Unite 5 here in Honolulu Union. So thank you, and we'll see you next week.
This has been the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sundays at 9 a.m. on K108. Tune in again next week, Sunday at 9 a.m. to the Carol Cox Show on 1080 a.m. KWAI Honolulu.